will probably go out the window. But so this is the continuing saga of your morphing cosmology lecturer. So I'm the next one. And I'll try to be, what I'm going to do is going to be relatively connected to what Andrew did. But at the same time, we're shifting gears a little bit because we want to go back to connect with observation. Okay. So let me just remind you sort of the overview of what we're going to do. When we started this whole discussion, you know, back only 7 days ago, however many days ago it was, we had the idea that we wanted to explain some sort of large-scale features of the universe, right? So basically, we wanted to solve these big problems of homogeneity and flatness, things like that. And so we had inflation as a solution or an explanation, let's say. Let's say solution to sort of large-scale issues, large-scale problems, let's say. And this was the flatness and why the CMB actually looks the same, even though it doesn't seem to have been in causal contact, homogeneity. And that was great, right? But basically, we decided that all we needed to do that, the only thing we needed, was to postulate there was something about the metric that was this accelerated expansion, and that could be sourced by anything that had the relevant equation of state, right? So something like W less than minus a third, and probably closer to minus one to get what we wanted. And that was it, right? That's all we needed so far to explain observation. And we said, okay, that could be done by a scalar field. And if you're sort of a really old school cosmologist, you're actually happy with just stopping at this level of description to some extent. You say, you tell me what kind of matter I need to source this accelerated expansion. Okay, that's it. We're done. And you can go even a little bit further, and you can explain a couple of the broad features that we're going to talk about later. So you know, at some level, you might be happy just to stop there. But what has happened, and I guess let me also say that most of the calculations that we've seen over the past week are actually things that people worked out in the late 70s, the 80s. You know, people were really excited about quantum field theory and curve space, things like that. But at some point, doing all of those calculations, you know, you can do so many interesting calculations, but you sort of lose direction or lose momentum if you don't have a connection to the real world. So the remarkable thing that we've been sort of setting the stage for is something much more powerful in terms of knowing whether inflation is the right theory or not than what we've said so far. So what we've been laying the groundwork for is something much more powerful. And that's the study of fluctuations or perturbations. So again, even though of course you can go ahead and do this, there's no reason not to do this, the reason that it's become of such interest within the last few years is of course because of observation. So we have a really remarkable set of detailed and increasingly detailed observations that allow us to calculate things that are much more predictive. So essentially the reason for this, of course, is observation. And if you think back, I'm not sure how many of you have taken sort of all the courses in this series, but if you think back, for example, if you saw Hirania's lectures, or if you go back and look at her notes, Hirania. Her starting point as sort of a cosmologist without this very early time phase was to say, well, all I need to explain the complete history of the universe and the whole distribution of structure that we see today is to suppose that basically there exists at some very, very early time a set of fluctuations in the metric, small fluctuations in the metric, right? So suppose there exists at an early time curvature, perturbations. And she would have written down something like this. She would have said, so what I need to do is suppose that I have some metric. And this thing now we're going to assume is driven by matter domination, radiation domination, the stuff that we actually see in the universe today. And that's the homogeneous thing plus some little perturbations. And she might have written something like this. So these are perturbations, spatial perturbations. Something like this. And these guys, phi and psi, so these are scalars. And you can do a lot of hard work, but sort of known physics work, to translate these guys into perturbations in, for example, the photon density, the cold dark matter. Density, et cetera. And from there, this was her starting point, and she could work out everything that we see today from that point. Okay? So the point is that essentially, you know, very roughly, for example, she would have something like, so say on large scales, she would have something like delta t over t is going to be proportional to phi, and maybe somewhat more precisely, from the Poisson equation, if I look at delta rho, for example, in cold dark matter, that's also going to go be related to phi. So what we need to do, what our goal is then, is to provide the prediction from inflation for this initial surface of curvature perturbations. And let me, often people call those primordial, to suggest that what we're going to predict doesn't need to have any additional sort of gravitational evolution or anything else. It's just that initial surface of perturbations for the primordial curvature perturbations. Okay? So it's probably worth, if you didn't look at it, just going back and reminding yourself of what the starting point was and how powerful this is. Okay. So what is our prediction going to consist of? What do we actually mean in more detail by prediction? We're going to mean statistics. And the starting point, or the simplest, you know, the first sort of obvious statistic that you can ask for, is the power spectrum. And this is essentially the Fourier transform of the two-point function. And it gives us the most basic information that we could possibly ask for, which is what's the amplitude of fluctuations. So you can already see that I'm doing something that's not very precise. And what I've done here, I have these two variables, phi and psi. We talked about fluctuations of the scalar field. Now I'm calling it curvature. So one of the biggest issues that we're going to have to deal with, which is actually going to be most of the rest of the course after this, is how to treat. I guess you can't see it by right over here, can you? So let me just say that the looming issue here is how to treat the scalar field plus the metric perturbations. And essentially, that is, what's the right variable? So just for today, I'm going to leave this issue aside a little bit, because that's going to occupy a lot of our time. Do you have a question?
Yeah. So, like, this one new equation delay amplitude density perturbations at some time to the perturbations at, some, like, fixed initial time?
Yeah. So always what you can imagine is that you start at some fixed time, and of course, you know, what I'm dropping here are all of the terms that tell you how to evolve these things with time.
Okay.
So you're right. A lot of what's in this proportionality is time evolution.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is extremely rough. But basically what I want to get across is, even though we have this big issue, what it's all going to come down to is that we're allowed to predict, essentially, the statistics for one of these variables. And then it's known physics, and it's often just proportionality and some simple limit of how you go to the variables that we want to actually compute in the end. So even though what you saw in Hirani's class is quite complicated, you know, it's very interesting physics about how you get from the initial fluctuations to everything that we see, at some simple level, you know, at least sort of intuitively, it's not that complicated. And so you can imagine that, if we can just give a prediction for, at some initial time, these statistics, then you can go ahead and work out all the rest from that. So I'm certainly not explaining any of that, but, you should go and, have a look back at the old lectures. Okay, so I'm gonna leave this aside for the moment, because I want to introduce to you a couple of important issues. And one of them is first just what's a simple definition of what we want to do here. So the first thing I want to say, so let's just say we're gonna leave this for tomorrow. Well, probably next week, we'll see. And I want to write down, give you some idea of what it is that we're looking for when we look for these statistics. Okay. So what's the power spectrum? So we can imagine that we take any variable that we like, basically. Let's take some dimensionless variable. And for if you want to be concrete, you can imagine that we're looking at the density fluctuations for cold dark matter, but let's make it dimensionless. And we want to know statistics of that guy, for example. Okay. So let's take this, so let's define this as delta. And we can expand delta in its Fourier series. So let's take delta of x and t, and we're going to write this as delta k. Something like that, okay? And looking, for example, at the CMB, we already know, we can already parameterize what this thing, what statistics of this thing should look like. So what we want to do is, for example, look at delta of x and t. Let me, t is fine for now. And delta y of t. So you can imagine people either taking two points in the CMB temperature map, right, and looking at all the correlations among those, and or points in the, distribution of density fluctuations. And we already have some set of information about this, basically. And you can probably guess what that information is. We know that in the CMB, you know, it doesn't, whatever two points we take, we should be able to move those points across the sky, right, essentially, and it doesn't matter what their orientation is. So there's some homogeneity and isotropy at work there. And none of that really matters. The only thing that matters, essentially, is the separation between the points, okay? So you can imagine that with some factors of 2 pi, oops, sorry, let me write this as, k1 and k2 now. That what's going to come in here is just a delta function in the momentum. Okay? So that delta function in momentum is the same thing that's going to give us a delta function in real space, telling us that the only thing that matters is the distance between the points. Okay. So you can see if you just go ahead and, so if we assume that what we're going to have is something that looks like this, you can relate this thing, the power spectrum, to the two-point function in real space. So now let's do this. And you can imagine that if I just plug in the Fourier expansions for both of these guys, right, at two different points, I'm going to have something that's written in terms of delta k1, delta k2 when I take the expectation value. Yeah. Sorry, this is the momentum. So. Oh, I'm sorry, this one? Yeah, so since it's a delta function, we can put either one there. Yeah. Okay, so now you can imagine just plugging in for both of these guys. You're going to get a delta function in momentum, which is going to drop for you one of these integrals, right? So what you're going to have left is something now that's dependent on x minus y, just the difference in the two points, and then this p of k. Let me put, yeah, here it's just k, so let's put. Yeah.
Does the delta function be k1 minus k2?
I don't actually. because basically I want these guys to close. So I want the sum of the momenta to be zero. That's right, so it looks a little bit different than what you usually write in the commutation relations. And so this is the power spectrum, is P. But we can even do a little bit better than that, because you can see that the only thing that matters here is x minus y. So in some sense, we can call this a variable r. And the only thing that matters here is the amplitude, essentially, of the momentum. It doesn't depend on the direction. So we have a lot of symmetry here. Okay, so we can do even better. And we can rewrite this. Is an integral over dk now. So basically I want to make some choice about how I'm aligning my vectors to have a simple symmetry here to simplify the problem. And we can write it as dk. Let me just keep all the factors for now. So from doing the angular integrations, I'm going to have some factor of 4 pi. I'm going to have p of k. I'm going to have a k squared, so let me write this as 1 over k here. Let's see what I'm going to do. Something like that, right? Okay. So what I want to do is write this in a simple way that looks so I can see what the dimensions are, okay? You can already see what the dimensions were by going back over here. So if this thing was dimensionless, then this is dimension 3. So this is dimension minus 3. There are two of them now, so this is dimension minus 6. This is minus 3. So this is minus 3. Okay? So you can already see what the dimension of this guy is going to be. And you can see that if we take out that, we're going to end up with something, a definition of what it means to be sort of independent of this k, or scale invariant, for the whole integral. Okay. So basically, you can write, I dropped the x minus y dependence here, but you can show that it becomes sine kr over kr. And if I'm looking, so r now is, where r is, let me define this thing here. So we said it just depends on the distance between the two points. So that's a two-point function of r, where r is the separation. Okay. So you can see that if we let this be small, so we look at the limit where these two points approach each other, and we can just send that guy to 1. And we can rewrite this as dk over k. And this becomes p of k times k cubed. And all that we have left here is a 2 pi squared. Okay, so if we can keep the, I think I want to do that. Yeah, okay. So now this thing is dimensionless. We said that this should have dimension k to the minus 3, but now we've multiplied by k to the 3, so this thing is dimensionless. So this is a nice combination to work with, and it's often what you see. And it's the dimensionless power spectrum, which is essentially, let's say, dimensionless power spectrum. And this is going to give us the variance, if you like. So this is the amplitude of fluctuations right here. So when you see a quote from something like WMAP, what you see is a quote for this amplitude. Okay? And if this P of k truly only goes as k to the minus 3, the whole thing is scale invariant. Okay? So we can actually then parameterize, if you like. So that gives us one number, essentially. So anything that doesn't look like that one number is going to have some additional scale dependence. And people typically write then that we can take this thing. So let's call this, this is often called just P without the curlies, P of K. So P of K then, phenomenologically, has to just be some amplitude. And if there's any scale dependence left over, It has to be, we have to write it as depending, as being with reference to some particular point. So this point is the pivot point. It's not really physical, but we don't want any additional dimensionful scaling here. And this tells us the variation of this thing from scale independent. Okay. So why does all this matter? It's going to matter because of the discussion we had yesterday about scale invariance in De Sitter. Okay. So all that we've done here is phenomenological. You can look at the CMB, and you can get a prediction for A0 and a prediction for how this has any additional dependence on scale. You find that it's very nearly scale invariant, but not exactly. Okay. So basically, this is related to an important point that's going to come up in many ways. And that is scale dependent. And what that means for inflation, basically, is that H dot is not equal to 0. Okay, and for the moment, you can sort of believe me by analogy with the discussion that we had yesterday. So if you remember, Andrew went through and he derived in the exact De Sitter space that the spectrum, right, for the scalar field was scale invariant. And we're going to go through this again in some steps. But a deviation from scale invariance in the observations is a deviation from exact De Sitter in the inflationary picture. Okay? And we can see in actually many ways why we can't have exact De Sitter. So let's talk about that. So So why is that? So we're going to see it actually in many ways, that it's actually quite important for all of the observations that we see. But we can go back to our original picture where we were just talking about the sort of classic features of this potential for the scalar field and the motion of the scalar field and that potential, and see that even at that level, we're going to have an issue. So people tried, let's say why, and this is certainly the first thing that people tried. So if you have H dot equals 0, that was this old inflation idea. And you might imagine that that works by drawing some potential that has a minimum here, let's say. Then it has some barrier, and it has some new minimum. Actually, I don't want to draw that. So here's some V0, and you might think that you could start in this minimum and eventually decay to this one. So this one is the false vacuum, if you like. Sometimes people say false vacuum or metastable. This is the true as in lowest energy. So you might imagine this is nice, right? Because during inflation, we have some large vacuum energy, if you like. And at the end, we have something that's almost zero to correspond with what we see today. So you might imagine this is the simplest realization of inflation. And if the field's sitting exactly here and it's exactly still, this is exactly H dot equal to 0, right? So this is the exact De Sitter case that we've been looking at. OK, so then you might ask, does this actually work, right? Have you guys talked about this before, actually? Yeah? A little bit? OK. So maybe you can remind me, why doesn't it work? A long time. Okay, that's all right. I just want to make sure I'm not repeating too much what you've already heard. So why does it work? Well, you have to say there's some tunneling rate from here to here, right? So we want basically, let's call it a nucleation rate for bubbles. And this is going to be a rate per unit time per unit volume, right? So you can write something like gamma over h to the 4. So let's try to imagine for a minute. Suppose that this rate is really low. So suppose this is really small. And that, in a way, looks good, right? Because we know we need a lot of inflation. So suppose you sit there in this false vacuum for a long time, you get a lot of inflation, and at some not too high rate, you tunnel out to the other vacuum, okay? So you can imagine that you make, yeah, go ahead.
With all the talk in the last week and a half about how you define pure spacetime. What do you mean by vacuum?
Yeah, okay, so here when I'm saying vacuum, I'm meaning sort of a classical minimum of this potential, right? So in addition, I think as we actually discussed before, if I want to talk about the quantum state of the particles here, I have to define that quantum vacuum as well. But here when I'm saying vacuum, I'm just talking about the minimum. So you would say that on top of this, you want to go to a particular good de Sitter invariant vacuum here. And also here, it's probably more like the usual Minkowski vacuum. So that's a sort of an additional step. Yeah, thanks. OK, so let's suppose that rate isn't particularly high. And let's suppose that I generate one bubble here and one bubble here. Even if those things expand at the speed of light, right, there's separation because the background space is still inflating. So the background space still is here. So they basically separate from each other faster than they can expand to hit each other, and they never collide. Okay? So essentially, bubbles never meet if this rate is really low. Why is that important? Does anybody remember? So let's say rate is very low. Bubbles never collide. And the reason that matters is that in the middle of the bubble, you have this, in the original state, you have this energy, right? The new state, in the middle of the bubble, you have this energy. But you also have some kinetic energy that lives in the bubble wall, and that's expanding out very rapidly. And that's where all the energy lives, right? Because you know that the middle of the bubble looks like this, flat space. So the energy lives in the bubble walls. And if the bubble walls never collide, then you never have any way of dumping that energy into anything else, like the matter that we see. Okay? So you never get anything except sort of a cold, empty universe. So bubbles never collide, you can never. So sort of the fancy way to say this is you can never reheat. And reheating is just what we call the time when we transfer the energy that was in inflation into the matter that we see, so that we can get, you know, the original idea of this hot Big Bang, where then the universe cools from there. Okay, well, you say, okay, let's try to change the rate, right, so that the bubbles do collide. So if the rate is large, now you can imagine that you don't spend very long in this phase before you start generating lots and lots of bubbles of this guy, right, and you have to generate lots of them within a Hubble time so that they don't inflate away from each other. But if that's true, you never spend very long in this initial phase, which essentially means you don't get enough inflation. So if you try to make the rate large, so things, the bubbles collide, not enough inflation. So I'm giving you very sketchy arguments, right? But you can go through and you can do very nice calculations to show all of these things. And basically what people realize very quickly is that even though this is this basic picture that we had of some, you know, de Sitter phase sourcing inflation, doesn't actually work in practice for these reasons. It can't actually give rise to what we see as our universe. Okay, so you can make this precise. And the upshot is it doesn't work. Okay. So we have to have this. So then people started, you know, trying to modify this picture, and they started drawing something where, okay, well, this didn't work. But now let's imagine that we just have one bubble, and then that bubble itself inflates, and for some time until we get to the end of inflation, something like this. And then essentially people realize that we can just excise off this whole part here. We don't need to talk about it. Okay? It's not a useful feature. And so then people essentially just said, let's call this the more modern version. This is a slow roll inflation, okay? Where the inflation takes place by this rolling down the hill. Okay? All right. So this really is going to be the source of all of the interesting physics that we see. It's basically going to allow us to have some real way of describing, you know, real physical fluctuations that are generated during de Sitter and come back in as real curvature perturbations. That difference is going to be crucial. Okay? So I guess I should have said this before, but let me just stop for a moment and emphasize to you that when we go past this initial picture of what inflation is, right, as just some source, you know, some particular equation of state in the stress energy tensor, and we try to be more careful and write down how to calculate these fluctuations, we're really taking inflation more to the level of particle physics now. So what it's going to allow us to do is actually try to identify, if we think this is the real answer, what could the inflaton possibly be, okay, in a more particle physics way. And that's where all the power of this comes in, because we have a way of asking much more precise questions, more detailed questions. So if you think, you know, you love your supersymmetry course or you love your string theory course, and you say, man, we have all these scalar fields, is one of them the inflaton? This is the kind of calculation that we're going to do in the next few days that you need to do to identify whether that works or not. Okay, so fine. H dot not equal to zero. But we can actually say a lot more than that, okay? So we can go further. And we can try to ask what else we know about H dot. Okay, so let's just go back. We remember H is A dot over A. So H dot is A double dot over A minus A dot over A squared. And it would be great if we could come up with an equation for H dot, right? That's very generic. Because if we have a generic equation for H dot, and sort of this generic background that we think is our inflating background, then we'll know some other property, okay? So that we can actually do that, no problem, because we have the Friedmann equations. And remember, these are just really the Einstein equations. So we expect that these are going to relate for us how the metric behaves to what kind of matter we have in a very generic way. And we have the one that you're very familiar with by now, right? Which relates H itself to the energy. Let's call it rho. Okay. And this is the 0-0 component of the Einstein equation, right? Because this is what lives. This is T0-0 for a fluid. Okay. So we also have then the spatial components, the II components of the equation. And I don't think we've written that one down yet, but that's going to actually give us something that is related to A double dot. Okay, so we also have two, so this is 0-0, this is II component. We have 2A double dot over A plus H squared is equal to now minus the pressure in Planck units. Okay, so I hope you can distinguish between my rows and my P's, but this is minus the pressure. And now you can see from here and here that we can actually get pretty easily an equation for H dot. So you can see that let's take this equation and let's subtract off this one, right? So let's take 2 A dot dot over A, and let's subtract let me divide by M Planck, so I have M Planck's on both sides here. So let's subtract 3 H squared is A dot over A squared, and that leaves me with a minus P plus rho over M Planck squared. Okay. Sorry, I dropped there was a plus H squared here from before. It's important. Okay, so you can see that these two combine, right? And now we have exactly 2 times H dot. Okay. But what do you remember about this quantity, rho plus P? I think this came up before last week, but essentially we have to have the condition that rho plus P is greater than zero. This is a version of the null energy condition. Which is a pretty strong condition on whether we think this is a reasonable space. Okay? So you can see that if this thing is greater than zero, what we just learned is that H dot must be less than zero. Okay, so not only do we have scale invariance, but we have scale invariance in a particular way, which is this way. And that's going to turn out to be, when we get there, something that is a powerful discriminator between a if you think inflation is the right description or a good description of what happened, and if you think some other theory is a good description. In principle, you can test it if you can check what this line of H dot. Okay, so we can just check quickly, so let's say quickly for our scalar field. It's a useful relationship to know what H dot is for the scalar field. And we can check, we can say, so let's see, what did we have? We had that 3 in Planck squared H squared was equal to rho, which in the case of the scalar field is the kinetic energy plus the potential energy. And this tells us if I take a derivative that, let me write it, 3 times 2 in Planck squared H H dot is equal to m squared phi dot. And here, I know how to take a derivative with respect to phi, but let me convert that to a derivative with respect to t by multiplying by a phi dot. So this is phi dot times a combination that basically we can recognize from the equation of motion, right? So this is, sorry, what am I doing? You guys don't even stop me. Why don't you stop me when I make silly things, right? Is 1 half phi dot squared, come on. So sorry, so this now is phi dot times phi double dot. There we go, that's the right combination, right? So now this is the right combination from the equation of motion, okay? I'm still missing a factor.
Friction.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I want to replace it by here, so that's what I'm missing. So basically, what we have is that this guy can be replaced by minus 3 h phi dot. All right, did I get that right? You guys got to check me. Okay. So what do we have? Now we have h's that cancel and 3's that cancel. And we have, can you see? Probably you can't see anymore when I write down so low. So what's left? Basically, what's left is that h dot is equal to minus, right? So now I have a phi dot squared, I have 1 half and an m Planck squared. It's basically just equal to the kinetic energy in units of m Planck. And that is indeed less than 0. Sorry, did I make a mistake or can you just not read my writing? Is it okay?
What is that last line?
This last line? Yeah, I'm sorry. So what I did here is I used the equation of motion. So remember we had that phi double dot, and we had the friction term. We had this equation for the equation of motion. So I have these two terms appearing there, so I'm replacing it by this one. Okay? Okay, so that's good. So this is not only a useful relationship to keep in mind, but it also verifies what we expected, which is that in this case we end up with h dot less than 0. So the, well, I should say less than or equal to 0. That's fine. Right, obviously, that if I go back to phi dot equals 0, that was the case where I'm just sitting at the minimum. So that's OK, too. OK, so all this discussion, so I'm trying to tell you that the deviation from exact is important. And yeah, I don't think you've seen fully exactly how important it is yet. But the fact that that deviation is so important actually inspires us to make a new definition of the slow roll parameter, right? So we know from this slow roll inflation picture that inflation does, in fact, look nearly de Sitter, but not exact. So if we can parameterize that invariance, that's a powerful way of thinking about inflation. So we do that by making a new definition of epsilon. And let me call it epsilon h to distinguish it from the epsilon v that you had defined before. And let's write that as minus h dot over h squared. So you can check pretty easily for yourself that during slow roll, this is very nearly equal to epsilon v. And so whenever you see epsilon written in parameters for inflation, it doesn't much matter which one you're talking about. And it signifies both that you have nearly a flat potential and that you have nearly de Sitter. Okay, so nearly flat. In simple models, in most models, nearly flat potential tells you that you're very nearly sitter. And the deviation from a fly potential is the deviation from the sitter, and it's captured by this primary epsilon. Okay. So we already said that this thing is negative, so it's clear that epsilon is greater than zero. Okay. But we can actually say something more. Yeah, sorry.
So frequent equations come from an action where you assumed an FRW universe, right?
That's right. That's right. This is very important.
We're still assuming an FRW universe, and these are variations away from the sitter within the FRW frame.
That's right. Thank you. Yeah. So what I've assumed here, right? I've assumed here essentially that I have. So I've assumed that the spatial part, for example, all the II equations are giving me the same thing. I've assumed that this is just a function of eta. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so basically the reason I'm allowed to do all of these steps at this point is that we believe observationally that we have nearly the sitter and we have homogeneity and isentropy, which allows me to choose this choice for the metric. Okay, that's also what allowed me to write that form of the power spectrum. Okay, so let's see what else we can say about, yeah. Yeah, these are cosmic times. So I'm going to try to use dots for cosmic time, primes for eta, and I'm going to try to write phi derivatives like this, although I may get confused and change my notation. Okay. Okay. So there's actually something more about this parameter that also makes it very useful for inflation. And basically for that, we can just go back to our expression that was the definition of h dot. So remember, I guess I erased it by now. Remember that we had, I don't want to write it. We said that a double dot over A was equal to, A dot squared over A squared plus H dot. Right, so before when I calculated H dot, I took the derivative of A dot over A. Now I've just rearranged that term slightly, okay? But now we can see that this is equal to, so this is h squared. And this guy is equal to minus h squared epsilon. So this is h squared times 1 minus epsilon. So now you can see that the other reason this definition of epsilon is nice is that if we want inflation, essentially, a double dot greater than 0, we must have epsilon less than 1. Okay, so it's a very nice parameter because it's between 0 and 1. The extent to which it's small is the extent to which you have nearly to sitter. Okay? So epsilon less than 1 is the condition for inflation. Okay, is all that okay so far? All right. So now I want to go back to the scalar field picture that we've been working with. And I want to show you again the issue of scale invariance versus scale dependence for the scalar field, okay? And how it's related to all of this. Yeah, so I guess I should say, so far, the fact that h dot was less than 0 would be the other thing that the standard cosmologist would say that we know about inflation. Okay, so that person would be happy if you say, we know that we can, if you just give me the equation of state and you gave me these sort of reasonable conditions, I would expect that we have a spectral index that's slightly less than 1. Sorry, that's red, essentially. And that's what you're going to show on the homework. And then the person would be done, essentially. Those are the features that we observed so far, small fluctuations and a particular scale dependence to the power spectrum. And that, at this level at least, is all we need. So if it was true that we were never going to do any better than, you know, measure just a little bit about the power spectrum, we might all be happy to just stop there and be done and go home. But the thing that's amazing is that our measurements keep getting better and better and better and better, right? So what we can do is we can actually ask not only questions about the power spectrum, but more detailed questions that go beyond that. And then it becomes much more relevant what the real physics is here, okay? So that's a lot of the motivation for actually continuing this discussion and trying to work out what the fluctuations are in terms of that scalar field. Okay, so we're going to go back to the scalar field. So again, I'm still going to be assuming that this is my metric, okay? And I'm going to assume that this thing doesn't have to be exactly the De Sitter form. So it's going to be set roughly e to the ht with some variation of h. H doesn't have to be exactly constant, okay? But I still want to stick with the fact that I'm homogeneous, isotropic, et cetera, so I want this form of the metric. Okay, so by now we worked out several times the procedure for how we get the what's going to look like the power spectrum for the scalar field, okay? So we have, let me write for you again. So basically, so we're just going to do the usual thing for the scalar field. I'm going to give it kinetic term and a potential. And let me write the potential in a particular way so that there's a constant piece and then there's the mass term for the field. Okay? So basically balancing off this term compared to this term is going to allow me to take an exact De Sitter limit, right? So if this V naught is much, much greater than n squared phi squared, this becomes more and more approximately De Sitter. Okay? As long as this term doesn't matter. Also, if I'm sitting exactly at zero. Okay, so now we can talk about the field sitting at the minimum versus the field sort of rolling. And I'm going to use this metric. Okay, so by now we're used to this. What's the usual procedure? So the first thing we do is get the equation of motion, right? And let me write it in conformal time, using conformal time. Because as we've seen, that's the best time variable to work with for our purposes. So can you still see at this level? No? Okay, sorry. Okay, so what did we have? We had phi prime prime. We had the single derivative term. Then we had the mass term and the spatial gradient term. Okay. There's an a squared. And so step two, we said let's take the Fourier transform. So we want to write the equation for each of the Fourier modes, right? And those modes aren't coupled, so that's very useful. So basically everything is easy, right? This just become phi k's everywhere, except for this one, which is going to give us a minus k squared. The next thing we did is we switched to the canonical field, usually. So we want to essentially remove that if we can. So we define u as a of eta times phi. And then we had a much simpler equation, right? Which was that u prime prime plus omega squared u was equal to 0. Where omega squared is this combination of mass terms and momenta. So omega squared, remember, was k squared plus a squared m squared. And then there's an additional term coming from the a itself, which is prime prime over a. So we know, actually, we can rewrite this a prime prime over a now in terms of r. So we've rewritten it before in terms of h. And now we can include an epsilon here. So you can go through that. It's not particularly hard, right? Because this is a d by d eta, and you want to convert it into a d by dt for h, which you can do with a factor of a. So when you do that, you get okay. So So before, I think we'd written this piece down. And now we have this piece as well. So if I want to go back to the exact de Sitter limit, I would let m go to 0 and epsilon go to 0. And then you see we're back to this relationship between k and ah. Right? OK. So remember that what we talked about yesterday is we have this separation. So let's say in the limit that m goes to 0, cm over h, and epsilon goes to 0. Remember that we had this separation of regimes, right? We had when k was less than ah and when k was greater than ah. And that's the difference between the oscillating behavior here and the exponential growing or decaying behavior here, right? So we had k less than ah. These are the long wavelength modes. So these are the, right, if k is small, the length is large. So these are super horizon modes. And we had this growing or decaying parts of the solution. So the horizon crossing point is where that behavior changes. Do you guys want me to go through that again, or do you remember? Yeah. Okay. Okay, so then we also needed the mode expansion. And for that we wrote u of eta, let me say eta and x spatial part, let's leave the time part as these mode functions. A. And we solve for u, right? And this A now is defining the vacuum. And we wanted to find exactly what those things were. Okay. So I think you've done this. I hope you've done this, because this is the most important calculation, basically, that there is, that you have to do over and over and over again for this type of problem. And basically, it helps if you write down for yourself a rearranged version of this equation, which is sort of a standard form of Bessel's equation. And I'm going to keep the epsilons now, but this is otherwise exactly what you've done before. Okay? And then you can always go to Mathematica or, you know, whatever, and look up and remind yourself what the solution to this thing is. And it's often written in terms of the usual guys. Sorry, every time an eta appears, right, remember it needs to be minus. Sometimes I drop these, but remember that eta goes from minus infinity to 0. So if you see funny signs appearing in square roots, just check that the etas are always defined such that quantity is positive. So let me try to keep that sign there. Right. And what we talked about before is that when we want to match the solution in the infinite past to the usual solution, the usual adiabatic solution, the combination of these guys that matters is one of the Hankel functions up to some normalization, which is a choice of these coefficients. Okay, so it's easier to rewrite these in terms of h1 and h2, which are complex conjugates of each other. And then you work out the solution, and you find, I'm just going to write it. Yeah, let me write what nu is. So nu, again, you know what nu is if you just go back to the standard solution of this guy. Okay. So what I'm doing here is just some algebra from if you look up the completely generic solution to Bessel's equation. Okay. Nu is 9 quarters this is square root over h squared, and there's still this epsilon in here if we want to keep it. Okay. So the exact De Sitter solution is nu equals 3/2, and then there's some small corrections. So let me just write down then the particular solution that we want to choose, which by now is familiar. So basically, choose coefficients to recover as t goes to minus infinity, the e, the minus. I omega t piece. Well, let me call it eta, sorry. And what we get from that is that uk of eta with the correct normalization is just that with a factor, sorry, it's proportional to that to pick up the correct one. And let me write you the full solution now for phi with the correct normalization so that you have it. Is a pi over root 2, partly because there's a root 2 over pi in there. There's a Hubble, eta to the 3/2. So the difference between this factor and this factor is coming from me converting back to phi. So there's a 1 over a in there. And then I have h nu minus k nu. Okay? So this solution is going to always work for us for inflation. And the only thing we have to worry about is nu. Essentially, okay? And that's going to contain, in general, some slow roll parameters. Okay? So you remember what we did at the very end of, I think it was the very end of yesterday, is we wrote the solution for, so for nu equals 3/2, things are particularly simple because you can write the exact solution. So yesterday, and it's h nu, but let me write out the actual functional form of it so that you have it. There's a root 2, it's a k cubed. Again, you can check the dimension, and ik eta minus ik eta. So often, if you want the lowest order solution for inflationary perturbations, you're going to rely on this expression. So what we did then yesterday was to evaluate this thing. And you can see that if you plugged in for each of these guys their mode expansion, right? We've done this a few times. You take the only piece that is non-zero, essentially, right, from the creation and annihilation operators. All that you're left with is an integral over one of the momenta essentially the mod squared of phi k, right, because there's one that comes in with a that's one that's just u or just phi and one that's u star in this e to the minus I k dot x minus 1. Okay, so that's the remember that's the form that we had when we started at the very beginning of the power spectrum essentially. We identified the thing that was the Fourier transform of the two-point function with the power spectrum, which is essentially this. Now. And when we plugged that in to evaluate it, we found so now I basically want to take the modulus of this thing, right? So phi phi star. So I'm going to have h squared. I'm going to have 2k cubed from the coefficient. The EVIs, I don't have to worry. I'm going to have 1 plus k squared theta squared. Okay? And for, again, for stuff outside the horizon, for long wavelength modes that aren't oscillating anymore, I can see that this thing, what I was calling curly P, goes to h squared over 2kq. OK, so what were the features that we noticed yesterday? We noticed that this thing is scale invariant, right? Kk constant k eta. So remember, if we took that scaling, eta goes to lambda eta, k goes to k over eta. Sorry, lambda. Thank you. Lambda. Right. We saw that this was the symmetry that we expected because that was a symmetry of De Sitter, and here we have it again. And as long as h is constant, again, this is that scale invariant of the power spectrum. Okay. So we see again that De Sitter is this scale invariant. So you can see that once we start allowing h dot to be not zero, right, we're going to have some additional k over k naught, again with some pivot factor there. Okay. So I think, I think I'll just stop with that for now. Okay, so this is an important point. Is everybody okay with this point? Okay. So what you're going to do in the homework is algebraically simple, but the concept is important because you're going to start relating the fact that you can exchange thoughts about time, with thoughts about where you sit on the potential, with thoughts about scale, of where things cross the horizon. Okay? And when you look at observations then, especially from the CMB, all of those notions of what that scale dependence means and where you know, what part of inflation you're seeing are important, and what information you're learning from that scale dependence. So that's going to be the tutorial. Okay? Okay.